BBC News.
Now, here's Clive Anderson with this week's edition of the discussion programme, which gets behind the legal issues of the day.
Hello and welcome to Unreliable Evidence. Now, this programme is about law and, I suppose, order. But what if a number of people don't agree with a particular law or a particular government policy and are willing to create disorder to oppose it? In a democracy, to what extent is the expression of dissent through individual or mass protest tolerable, legal, or even desirable? If we have a right to take to the streets to oppose a war, to object to an airport, because the G20 leaders are in town, to argue for or against fox hunting, to what extent is it the government's or the police's duty to give us the time and space to do it? On the other hand, how far is it proper for the police to go to restrict the movements of crowds to keep them away from one area or kettled in another when things threaten to boil over? In recent years, the government has taken wider and wider powers to restrict where and how demonstrations may take place. Police tactics have apparently included infiltrating protest groups and rounding up troublemakers before they've had a chance to make any trouble. Are these and other devices calculated to emasculate the power of mass protest, or methods necessary to avoid descent into mob rule? To discuss all this in an orderly and possibly peaceful way, I'm joined by a small gathering here to demonstrate their legal and other expertise. Lord Hoffman has just retired as a law lord, began life in South Africa as Leonard Hoffman. I say that in case anyone was impertinent enough to refer to him as Lenny. Lord Hoffman of Chedworth spent 12 years or so in the highest court in this country, the House of Lords, the culmination of a particularly distinguished legal career as a barrister and judge. Professor Jim Waddington is the director of the History and Governance Research Institute at Wolverhampton University. He's founder member of the International Consortium on Police Use of Force and a member of a variety of high-level advisory groups in relation to police issues and the author of, amongst other publications, Liberty and Order, Policing Public Order in a Capital City. Stephen Cragg is a barrister who frequently acts for clients in actions against the police, co-author of the Legal Action Group publication Police Misconduct, Legal Remedies. And Amy Street is also a barrister, specialising in police law, frequently involved in representing the police in court, also advises police on issues and policy. She's the co-author of a book called Public Order, Law and Practice. So, but I'll start at the top with Lord Hoffman. Is there a right to protest we can recognise?
There isn't a legal right to protest. Well, there's no legal right to do anything unlawful in the course of a protest. Mm. But there is, in this country, a convention, an understanding that has existed for many, many years, that people do occasionally break the law while protesting, that that is accepted. They may be punished, taken to court, fined. They're usually not fined very much because one recognizes their right of protest, and they, on the other hand, behave in a reasonable sort of way. Although they do things which break the law, they don't do anything too outrageous. That is the convention and understanding that we've lived with for a long time.
Mm. Well, that's, I suppose, a fairly vague way to put it, though. As long as they don't do anything too outrageous, then they're sort of okay conventionally.
Yes. I mean, a form of protest which goes back to the suffragettes, if not earlier, is that you go and chain yourself to some object or railings or make it difficult for people to take you away, cause a nuisance. Quite often that's illegal. Often you've gone onto other people's land in order to do so. It's called aggravated trespass. The police find it tiresome, but it is a form of protest which we've accepted for a while, a long time, and which I think a democracy should be able to accommodate.
Professor Waddington.
I would add that the vast majority of protest demonstrations involve some illegality. The police are usually very tolerant of this. They will often facilitate actions which are contrary to law. These may be, for example, the Hyde Park regulations or the Trafalgar Square regulations, of which there are many, mm-hmm. and which it is very difficult not to to breach.
Well, we'll come back to that point, but if you start off in my protest, is I just going to gather, you know, 100 or 1,000 like-minded people, we're going to walk along, we'll have some placards saying bring down the government for whatever reason. I'm not breaking the law at that point, am I?
No, that's a polite protest, and that is the sort of protest that hardly gets any hearing. So if you're going to make any kind of statement or you're going to do anything that brings attention to your cause, you're usually going to have to commit some kind of technical offence.
Stephen Cragg, on the European Convention on Human Rights, do we have a right to protest there and indeed under the common law, would you say?
Well, I think European Convention on Human Rights gives us two important rights, the right to freedom of expression and also the right to peaceful assembly as well. And I think what the European Court of Human Rights has said is it's not just a right which means that the police shouldn't interfere with the right, but there's also a duty on the state to enable those rights to take place. And so when you're looking at protests and demonstrations, then I think there is some duty on the state to recognise that it's an important part of a democracy for these things to take place and to enable them.
So how do we construe that at a simple level? If I, again, back with my march, with my 1,000 friends and placards saying, bring down the government, I want to go along a particular street, let's say Oxford Street in London, is there a duty for the police to stop the buses or stop the traffic in order to allow that to take place? Or is it a bit vaguer than that?
Well, I think it is quite vague, but I think what has to be recognised is that simply because it's inconvenient isn't necessarily going to be a reason to stop you walking down the street. I think the police should be thinking about exercising their powers in a way which helps you to exercise your right of peaceful assembly.
All right, Amy Street, just to check that you're, you know, with everybody else on this, there is a right, is there, to demonstrate, to protest?
There certainly is a right under Articles 10 and 11 of the European Convention, the right to freedom of assembly and freedom of expression. And in my experience, there are two rights which the police take very seriously indeed. And it's easy for the media, for example, to forget the undeniable success which the police have had in this country of facilitating protest. And one good example in recent years is the Stop the Wall march in 2003, where there were, I think, on the smallest estimate, it's about 750,000 and perhaps a couple of million people walking through the centre of London. And that's something which is to the credit of the Metropolitan Police and happened as a result of the fact that they take their duty to facilitate protest where it's appropriate and where the balance is appropriate very seriously.
Well, that, I suppose, takes us to an aspect of this. A relatively peaceful march, people walking down the street, a high number of people, if it's as many as a million, that would be really quite a substantial demonstration. But it didn't actually have a huge effect on government policy, which it might have done if it had turned into more of a riot, the way, say, the poll tax riots turned into what it was 10, 20 years ago. So is that the boundary that we're having to look at?
Well, it would be very odd, I think, to say that the police have a duty to facilitate protest, which is going to be violent and disorderly.
No, I wasn't suggesting that. I was mainly making the point that if police facilitate a pleasant, peaceful march involving many thousands, maybe as many as a million people, but all it does is mean that people walk along and they've let off steam, they've expressed an opinion, but it's got them nowhere. It may be that we're, you know, it's a rather complicated way to achieve nothing for anybody. Lord Hoffman.
I don't think there's any correlation between the degree to which a protest is violent and what it achieves. The poll tax was a deeply unpopular tax and an unreasonable tax to have imposed, and that's why it failed, not because there was a violent protest one day.
Well, don't you think that was an aspect of it, though, that illustrated how worked up some people were?
On the contrary,
about it?
I think that on that particular occasion, there were people who wanted to cause trouble, who took advantage of the unpopularity of the poll tax in order to go out and make trouble.
But as far as the right to protest, the right to demonstrate, it's clearly limited by there's no legal right to commit violence or to destroy property. So it's not an unfettered right by any means.
No, that's right. And I think Article 11 actually talks about peaceful assembly. That's what it relates to. And so I don't think anyone here is going to advocate for the right to violently protest and not to be for that.
But it is those very few, very rare episodes which are the ones that come to such public attention.
But let's go to Lord Hoffman's point, though, that there's a sort of an acceptance, there's a certain give and take about this. You can break the law a bit, if that's what I'm interpreting what you're saying, in order to make your point. So you could, daub a wall with a slogan. You wouldn't necessarily expect to be arrested immediately for criminal damage, or that might be criminal damage.
That's true, and I think Amy made a very important point a moment ago, which is that on the whole, the police do take it seriously, and they do a lot to facilitate these kinds of protests, even if there is going to be some breaking of the law. What goes wrong occasionally is sometimes you have a policeman who gets his powers wrong and thinks that he's entitled to do something which he's not entitled to do in perfectly good faith, because he thinks that's going to prevent trouble. And occasionally you have slightly worrying developments where you feel that the police have taken a certain course simply not to be put to the trouble of having to police a demonstration. But on the whole, I think one's bound to say that it works quite well.
So if somebody goes on a demonstration and breaks the law, it may be something simple like, you know, all sitting down in the street, so it's obstructing the highway, and then they might get some of them arrested. Should they just take their punishment and just say, okay, that was, I deliberately broke the law, okay, I'm arrested, I'll have to be fined or maybe even spend a night in the cells? Is that all part of the process?
Yes, that's part of making the point.
But usually people aren't arrested. It's very rare for people to be arrested on a demonstration. It's very rare for them to have a charge preferred against them once they've got to the station. Because even when there's disorder, the police have a very strong vested interest in simply dealing with the disorder. Now, what you don't want is all your police officers arresting people, because you won't have any police officers on the street dealing with the remnants of the disorder. You very quickly run out of cops in that way.
If you take the protests at Fairford in 2003, there were quite a few people there who went a lot further than just a peaceful protest. They broke the perimeter wire of the airport. They went in, they did some damage to vehicles. They were arrested. They were put before the magistrates at Cirencester. They all got conditional discharges, or pretty well all of them did. This is the give and take that one expects.
But that got as far as a case in the House of Lords, in front of you and another law lords,
yes.
Case of Jones. So that was a protest about the Iraq war.
Yes.
So the argument advanced in that case, as I understand it, was, well, we may have committed some misdemeanours or offences,
yes.
But this was in opposition to a much more unlawful thing like a war. That was the argument. Which was
and we rejected that argument. Yes. We said that's a question of whether the war is unlawful or not. That's a matter for the democratic process. It doesn't entitle you to go and retaliate by committing unlawful acts yourself.
So you weren't prepared to go into... I'm going to come to you in a moment, Stephen, but you weren't prepared to go into that question and say... there's a cut-off point dealing with the facts of the case. Whatever was going on in Iraq or whatever, or any other issue...
It didn't matter.
No. Stephen Craggs, are you happy with that position?
I think that's a good example of people who have committed offences during demonstrations who aren't prepared to just take the punishment from the courts and want then to use the courts as a way of mounting a defence that the wider public good justifies the offences that they've committed. And I think that's still a widespread view that the criminal courts could be used or should be used for those kind of defences. Even though I know the House of Lords,
and sometimes that those defences are successful. There was the Faslane case and other cases of criminal damage where
I think the GM crop sort of cases where these arguments arise in different circumstances. If you're in front of a jury, it's if you've got a barrister who wants to make this point, can argue in front of the let my clients off because they were doing it to save your planet from destruction or whatever the argument is.
Well, there's nothing you could do to stop a jury from acquitting, but I think the point that we made in the Fairford case was that the examples that have just been given about Faslane and GM crops were wrong. Those people should not have, as a matter of law, been acquitted simply on the grounds that they were seeking to stop what they described as some other unlawful act.
Well, I suppose in many offences there are terms that you can seize upon, like, you know, unlawful or honestly or dishonestly, and say, well, exploring that word, this is what operates in our mind. That's, I'm sure in your barristering days you explored words like that for benefit of clients.
And so they did, but we said they were wrong.
Can I just challenge something that Lord Hoffman has just said about, you know, this as being the unfettered decision of a police officer? In the 100 or so demonstrations that I observed in researching for the book you mentioned, what drew the distinction was the amount of political pressure. G20, why there were problems there is on the can. It was because there were 20 heads of state, heads of government, and this was a big national issue, and it was to do with the future of the economy, and they did not want at any price... another battle of Seattle where President Clinton was holed up in his hotel and couldn't get out.
That so when you say they, you mean the British authorities, the government?
Yeah, the government.
So the
Foreign Office.
The instruction to the police, insofar as it able to convey an instruction in these circumstances, was make sure it's all kept under control.
Yes, and they do. I mean, those instructions are quite clear. The Foreign Office is quite clear about visiting heads of state. The police have a phrase that they describe as dying in a ditch.
Yes.
And they don't dig the ditches.
Amy, you represent the police on many of these cases. We've mentioned you've played a part in the case. Do you recognise that as an approach of the police, that they come under greater political pressure on some occasions than others, and it affects how they do their policing?
Well, that's probably true, but my experience has shown that what they are really focused on is the need to prevent disorder, and potentially very serious disorder. In the years running up to the May Day demonstrations in 2001, which resulted in a case going to the House of Lords, there had been very serious disorder in London on the occasion of anti-capitalist demonstrations.
On these May Day demonstrations?
On the May Day demonstrations and other related occasions, which included, for example, scenes of a police van being turned over and set on fire at Euston Station, and a policewoman being pulled off her horse. And on May Day 2001, the police had intelligence that there was going to be disorder, including looting and violence of the most serious kind seen in London. So that on those occasions, it was the need to prevent disorder and to protect people and their property, which, in my experience, motivated the police.
But there was an awful lot of criticism the year before, 2000, and I was in Parliament Square with the police on that occasion, when Churchill's statue was daubed and, more importantly, the cenotaph was desecrated. And I know, I can remember when it came known that the cenotaph had been desecrated, because the commanding officer turned to me and said, now they've done it, and within minutes, everybody was, what we'd now say, kettled into Parliament Square and into Trafalgar Square. So there are these red lines, and the police know where they are, by and large.
Well, let's come to these methods of control. You mentioned in passing there kettling, which has become quite a sort of fashionable word for people operating these circumstances. Stephen, I suppose perhaps you could just explain the system of kettling, because it's quite an evocative term, and it is quite understandable once explained.
It is. I'll do my best. It's a term which is used when the police decide they're going to restrict a number of people, often large numbers of people within a certain area for a period of time, and essentially there's officers all the way around them, and the people within that cordon aren't allowed in or out. And it can happen to peaceful groups of demonstrators if the police think that there's violent demonstrators outside trying to get in, or it can happen to violent groups of demonstrators as well. The real concern, I think, which is raised by a lot of people, is that if you are a purely peaceful demonstrator and you're restrained in this way, often for hours and hours. I think the May Day situation in 2001 was 8 hours, and I think the Kettle for the Climate camp at Bishopsgate last month, people were restricted for 3 or 4 hours before they could get out. I mean, what do you do? Where are you going to go? You can't go home. You can't, if you've got childcare problems, all that kind of thing. And it should be a tactic of last resort. I think the problem is that there are concerns that now the police have the power and know how to use it, then they're going to use it as a, not necessarily first resort, but something they're going to use on a more regular basis than they have been doing.
Well, I think, Lord Hoffman, that's what the House of Lords did say, that this it's an acceptable tactic in special circumstances.
In special circumstances, and as Amy was explaining, the circumstances were pretty special there, because there was a really serious fear of violence. What worries me more than that is the preemptive action.
Can we come to that in a moment, though? I just want to deal with Kelly, because Amy was involved in that case in which it's been considered. And I just get that sort of picture sort of painted, which is you've got a demonstration there as a tactic police have devised of sort of corralling people. I think the imagery of the kettle is that they're supposed to be letting people away gradually, like steam escaping from a kettle, so that people who have to go can go, and it stops there being a mad rush from one place to the other. So I can see how in theory it might work, but if you are, as Stephen's describing, people standing around, kept there for hours on end, it's actually going to create, or could create, more trouble than it solves.
Well, I think there's a serious danger that the picture painted by Stephen's description may be misleading in rather subtle ways about what the police are doing. For a start, I don't actually know where the term kettling comes from. I don't think it's a police term. It's not one that I've heard in my experience. I don't know whether it comes from the media, from protesters, from abroad, but it's not a police term. And to suggest that it is creates a picture of what the police are trying to do, which is wanting to bring people to a boiling point, whereas what they want to do is the exact opposite of that. They want to contain a problem. And also, to describe it as a police tactic which they've devised is, of course, true in one sense, because it's one of the methods they have in their range of tactics which they can use if the need arises. But it's not something that the police decide to do in advance because they want to keep the protesters in one place.
Wasn't the decision taken to use in advance for the G20 demonstrations?
I don't know. I imagine that it would have been one of the tactics that was considered, and if the circumstances arose to make it justified, then it would have been put into place. But it would be wrong for the police to decide in advance that that's what they should do.
Can I just mean Professor Waddington, yes, because you have on-the-ground experience and study this.
I was actually involved in the evolution of kettling.
Did you invent the term?
I'm not sure the term
is the most important thing.
I don't approve of it either.
All right, we're on a call.
I knew it was just containment, but... Yeah.
Call it a pot or kettle.
There was a time when the protesters, after the initial flurry of violence, sat down outside the National Gallery. And then there was because the mounted officers couldn't keep the horses standing around, there was a sort of, we better get this lot dispersed. And they were then dispersed, and they went all over the West End. And there were bushfires going on till after midnight that night. And I did say to the Assistant Commissioner of Territorial Ops, I don't think that was a very clever move. I think you would have been better to keep them where they were.
So you invented kettling. It's my fault.
Yeah. But also, one of the points about it was to keep everything as calm as possible, because the other alternative tactic of last resort is dispersal. And in dispersal, what you get is people rushing around. Mm. And so if you're riding a horse very fast, if you're driving a vehicle very fast, and you're a police officer, you're getting also pretty excited. So the whole idea was to try to keep control, not only of the protesters, but also of the officers themselves. And, of course, in a dispersal, they will end up all over the place. In this containment operation, you can have command over those officers. You know what they're doing. You can collect evidence. You can let people go and then arrest others and so forth.
Well, what is your, as it were, academic conclusion about this tactic, whether it's invented by the police or forced upon them or planned in advance? Do you think it's a useful thing that is effective and the better of two evils?
Yes, I mean, as a last resort, and it's always a question of proportionality, as a last resort, it is by far and away superior to what the Continental Police do, which is to fire tear gas and put people to flight.
Because, I mean, I just in passing, obviously we must mention that somebody died at the G20 disputes, and that seems to have been in the context of kettling, but we don't know exactly
yet. Bear Peach was killed back in 79 at the Southall demonstrations.
Well, of course, if you're hit on the head, you can die.
But that's what happens in a dispersal.
Yeah, well, not necessarily, but Stephen Crouch.
Well, we've not heard the last of whether the police tactics on May 2001 were lawful or not, because that's going off the European Court of Human Rights. It was controversial. And I'm sure that the kettling tactics used by the police at the G20 as well, I think there's going to be a legal case as well, which will decide whether they were lawful or not. So I think we're going to hear more from the courts about how these tactics by the police are used.
So the legal work is dispersed and not kettled amongst the few.
Or
no,
can
so,
we get off this?
But as I said before, there's a real concern that it's going to be used more than it should, I think.
Mm. Okay, well, now Lord Hoffman was mentioning that there are other aspects to this, not just kettling, because it's you can use intelligence and find out what's going on, and even arrest people has been done in recent cases on the assumption there might be something's being planned or that the demonstration may get out of hand.
For my part, I see no objection to the use of intelligence. I mean, after all, the police should have intelligence. But I am concerned about certain preemptive action. For example, at the Ratcliffe Power Station, I think it was earlier this year, in which the police arrested 100-odd people before any demonstration had taken place on the basis that and then charged them with conspiracy to trespass, to commit aggravated trespass, and with conspiracy to commit criminal damage.
Yes.
And as I understand it, what they found was that these people had some bolt cutters. Mm. Well, I mean, that suggests the sort of protest that one had at Fairford and that one constantly has, and which good policing ought to be able to contain.
Yes.
And to preempt that by going and arresting these people seemed to me an overreaction.
So you can spell out an argument that a crime has been committed, because if they've made an agreement to do something, that could be a conspiracy. So there are grounds for arrest if you can make that out on the evidence. But you're saying that even if you can do that...
It's the spirit of our attitude to protest.
So essentially what you're saying is that people should be allowed to protest, and they should be able to break the law a bit. To make their protest.
Precisely.
Yeah. Have you got a sort of level of how far the law breaking you'd be prepared to countenance?
Well, I think that's fairly well established. I mean, that trespassing, a certain amount of daubing of slogans, chaining yourself to railings or to objects, like at Twyford Down back in when they were digging the motorway through there and people went and chained themselves to the bulldozers. Perfectly respectable people who felt very strongly about this. And that sort of feeling ought to be recognised.
Yes.
I think one of the things about Radcliffe, which is important...
Is
that it is a private company. And the police who I have experience from the live animal exports have been wrapped very firmly over the knuckles by the House of Lords, I believe, eventually. It was a High Court who said that the action taken there to schedule the deliveries to the ferries was to give in to mob rule.
No, on the contrary, the House of Lords said that that was quite the wrong way of looking at it, and that it was a perfectly lawful exercise of police discretion.
Stephen?
But I think it's right that the preemptive strikes that the police take, I mean, the danger is that can extinguish the right to protest before it's even taken place. And the other thing which is concerning is bail conditions which are placed upon people as well, which are so stringent, which means they can't meet with their fellow demonstrators. And they're restricted from going to certain places.
So taking that stage, you can get arrested for, let's say, and charged with, or not even necessarily charged, but accused of maybe a conspiracy, but you're released on police bail in any event, and the condition of the bail is you don't go on a demonstration that's been discussed, or any demonstration at all, I suppose it could be.
Or you don't contact people who've been arrested with you and that kind of thing. And I'm sure there's going to be a legal challenge on that. There's a breach of Article 8, right to private life, and that kind of thing.
So you're suggesting then that the tactic isn't aimed at preventing things getting out of hand, but preventing any sort of demonstration anyway, as though the police are trying to stop there being a protest about the issue, whether it's a power station or animal exports or the war in Iraq. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, that's right. I think you're going back to the positive rights in the European Convention of Human Rights, the right to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and the state's duty to encourage those. And then, on the other hand, you have the police coming in and with these preemptive strikes, if you like, which stop that taking
place. What I'm slightly worried about is this might be just a purely budgetary consideration, but it's cheaper to go along in the middle of the night, as these people did at 12 o'clock at night, and arrest 100-odd people than to have to send a lot of policemen to police the demonstration on the following day.
All right, so just saving money. Amy Street, what do you say about this? Because you've been involved in these, again, these cases that have concerned preemptive tactics.
Yes,
can you justify them?
Well, there was
just right at the House of Lords.
There was another Fairford case, case brought by Miss Laporte, who was one of the people who was on three buses travelling from London to Fairford to protest against the war in Iraq. And in that case, the police stopped the coaches before they got to Fairford, while they were a few kilometres away, and directed that the coaches and the passengers be sent back to London. So that was a case of a preemptive arrest, although those people weren't actually arrested. The police were using their powers to prevent a breach of the peace to send them back to London.
So that's the justification, but it obviously undercuts the right of protest if you're going to be sent back before you've... as I put in the introduction, before you had a chance to create trouble, you're being... I think the decision there was only if you could be identified as a troublemaker could this tactic be employed against you.
Well, the decision in that case was that a breach of the peace wasn't imminent, so it was too soon to take any of that action. And that's why the House of Lords decided in that case that the action that Gloucestershire police had taken was unlawful.
But it sounds fundamentally wrong anyway, doesn't it, to be trying to prevent people even getting to the protest and saying, well, no, we're not allowing that. Would you think it was a budgetary thing, that, like Lord Hoffman was suggesting, or
no,
was it a tactical thing, or just trying to stop the protest at all?
Well, it's firstly a question of balance. The police are trying to strike the right balance between preventing disorder and allowing the protests where appropriate. And in that case, one of the law lords said that it was an error of judgment that the police made. Mm. It wasn't a fundamental mistake in their approach. It was an error of judgment on that occasion. But the difficulty that the police face is, if you lose order, if disorder breaks out, it can be very difficult to bring it back.
Yes.
So you can't, if the police are to protect us, you can't say that they have to wait until the last possible moment when it's absolutely certain that something very bad is going to happen before they can take action. Yeah. You have to allow the police to take action in advance where a breach of the peace is imminent and where the action that they take is proportionate.
Well, I take that point. Obviously, the police get it in the neck either way. If the border breaks down, they look like Keystone Cops and they look ridiculous. If they're too oppressive, they look like, you know, Nazis. And that's, you know, they've got to keep between those parameters. But does this go back to sort of the treatment of miners? And
Moss v. McLaughlin.
Yeah.
And the crossing the Thames Estuary by the Kent miners, that was deemed to be too preemptive, but a mile or so from the pit was accepted. I'd like to go back to the point that was made about bail conditions, because I think this is really important. This has got to be the civil libertarian nightmare, because bail conditions were introduced in the 70s under the Bail Act as a way of keeping people out of prison who would otherwise be held on remand. And the sort of the trade-off was, well, if you allow them on bail but they have conditions on, then those people can stay in the community. That was a liberal-inspired measure. But then several decades down the line, and indeed during the miners' strike, there are suggestions that this was then used very freely to decimate people on the picket line.
Well, I'm letting us drift back to the miners' strike, but it's my fault. But more modernly, more up to date, we've got the Serious Organised Crime and Police Act and a variety of other measures taken by this government to do with restricting demonstrations in Parliament Square, powers of arrest. Stephen, do you think the government's gone too far or given too many powers to the police? They have ancient existing powers to arrest for breach of the peace and for swearing and stuff, but then there's also ones about, you know, if you can't, not allowed to read out the names of the war dead next to the cenotaph if it happens to be in a designated area and you haven't applied for a licence to do a demonstration.
Yeah, well, I think there are concerns that some laws have gone too far. The restrictions on demonstrations around Parliament Square, I think the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights has been taking evidence on that in the last few weeks.
Yes.
And the current restrictions don't seem to have very much support for anyone at the moment. Even the police think they're too hard to work. And the kind of restrictions that you have to give 6 days notice before a demonstration takes place. So I think there's sort of a rowing back from that, and I think it's probably quite likely that the law's going to change. But there's a range of other laws which have been introduced over the last few years, which people think do add to the restrictions.
Stop and search powers on the Terrorism Act and things like that,
stop and search powers, which again, I think the police are saying they've gone too far on that. And things like the extension of the Protection from Harassment Act to include demonstrators and that kind of things, number of examples.
What do you think about the sort of bureaucratisation of this sort of thing? So you've got to register that you're going to have a demonstration. There's a comedian and activist called Mark Thomas who's made a big thing about registering individual demonstrations. And cyclists who want to demonstrate a fallen foul, as well, they haven't got a designated route; they just want to cycle around.
Well, the House of Lords said they didn't have to register.
Indeed. Yeah. But do you think that, as a general rule, though, Lord Hoffman, we've entered an area where there's lots of regulations and rules which individually might each be justified, but it's again a sort of undermining of ability to make anything like a spontaneous demonstration, because you've got to give notice and keep out of areas you want to go into, and that there's a sort of two levels of demonstration. There'll be a registered demonstration and one that insists upon breaking those laws as well.
Yes, I'm not sure that that causes a great deal of practical difficulty, does it? I mean, the Tamils seem to have turned up in Parliament Square in great numbers and done their demonstrations.
And stayed and remained. Yes.
Without any difficulty. Yes.
And they've had to work around, I've forgotten his name for the moment, that's awful, is it Brian Hoare, you know, who's been sitting there for years on end, despite legislation brought in specifically to get rid of him, which seems to miss him every time. Well, it's got him now, but he's still there.
I feel less sympathetic towards him, speaking as somebody who works close to Parliament.
Yeah.
But let's also note that for decades, probably from 100 years or more, The sessional order, as it was called, passed by both houses of parliament, each session instructing the Metropolitan Police Commission to keep the thoroughfares free, effectively had a sessional area associated with it, which stretched from Leicester Square tube station in the north right the way down to Lambeth Bridge in the south, and a large area to the west and the other side of the river, in which protest was just not tolerated at all.
So are you less concerned about recent legislation?
Well, I think it's a restoration of the status quo ante, really. The parliamentarians are very jealous of their privileges. And it's not uncommon in other jurisdictions. I mean, very often it's known as the banning mile in continental countries.
And they've attempted it even in Washington to prevent demonstrations.
It's very effective in Washington. You try to demonstrate outside of the mile and you'll have a very hard, tough time. And if you want to do it in the mall, you have to go and register with the National Parks authorities.
Another thing we do have in our modern age is there's a lot of cameras now. There's surveillance cameras, everybody's phone's got a camera. And this cuts both ways, of course. This is useful for the police to get evidence against demonstrators, but demonstrators are turning it on the police as well. Do you think that's going to add to the, well, I don't know, better behaviour of demonstrators? Everyone realises their actions can be filmed and recorded. Steve,
it's been a long time coming, isn't it?
I hope it'll lead to the better behaviour of the demonstrators and of the police.
Yeah. Is there any evidence to show that's occurring, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, as somebody who's advised demonstrators over the years who claim to be victims of excessive force used by the police, sometimes it's very hard to prove. And you are saying to people, well, look, if it was on camera, then perhaps we'd be able to prove it in court. Of course, now it is, more and more. And so I think that is a big change, and I think that will make the police more accountable.
But the important thing that the police have always had to bear in mind when using the footage that they take during public order events, and now with the protesters taking their own footage, is that it's important to take into account the bigger picture. What you see in the one shot of a police officer and an individual having a confrontation is, of course, very important because it allows you to see exactly what's happened. But the context, the reasons why that has happened, may be very relevant to whether what the protesters are doing is lawful and what the police are doing is lawful.
Sure. And, of course, I'm bearing in mind there are cases going on about this, even tragic ones, that they will have to look at the expanded picture. But I suppose the message that comes through this, an awful lot of things to do with the police, is there's no substitute for having a disciplined, well-behaved police force, because if that goes wrong, then everything goes wrong.
Of course. Mm. And the police are given, in the powers that they have, a lot of discretion as to what they do, which is necessary because they need flexible powers so they can take the action which is appropriate in all the circumstances, tailored exactly to what's happening. Mm. But that imposes on them a high requirements. They need to act properly.
Yeah. Now, look, we started the discussion by considering it is a sort of a right to demonstrate, a right to protest, but is this a particularly convenient way of deciding issues? It's quite clumsy, isn't it? To take a worked example, there's a lot of demonstration about vivisection, against vivisection, I think, in Oxford, and then somebody then organised another demonstration to be in favour of animal research, and by that way you can work out there's a sort, and with countryside marches, there's a countryside march that might call for the restoration of fox hunting, another march to show, no, this is a barbaric practice and it should be banned. Is this a particularly convenient way in a mature democracy to take decisions, or is this something we should grow out of?
It's the Garvaki Road problem, isn't it? You know, you've got the Republicans who say, we don't want you walking through our neighbourhood, and the Loyalists who say, we want to protest down that street.
Yes.
And you have those rights in conflict, and very often there are rights in conflict. That's in the nature of rights.
But Stephen Craig, do you think this is just something, protests will always be with us, and that we want to accommodate it, or is it something that is an inconvenient way to take decisions?
It may well be an inconvenient way. It may be clunky, it may be messy, it may be hard to police, but I think it's also a fundamental part of our society as well, and it's not going to go away. Mm. The police need to police it as well as they can and fairly as they can, taking into account people's human rights, and the government, parliament, passing laws needs to take those things into account as well.
I was going to there's a point which Lord Hoffman made earlier, I think, which is very important, which is that sometimes there are people who may not believe so strongly in the cause that everyone else is demonstrating about and may seek to use the opportunity of the demonstration for violence. Mm. And that's something which causes difficulties for the police because they have to try as best they can to work out who it is who's going to cause the violence and who it is who's there to protest peacefully.
And some people's tactic may be essentially to provoke the police as part of the publicity and as part of a political message. They look what the police are like. If we've prodded them, and then they've responded, that is part of the whole procedure. Yeah. So, Lord Hoffman, do you think the law is... We're coming to the end of our time here, I'm afraid, but do you think the law that we have is essentially right? It's got to be right, or is there improvements that we can suggest?
I don't think that the law that we have is particularly wrong, but I think it's important to keep hold of the conventions, of the democratic conventions. I think that demonstrations are an inconvenient, messy, difficult way of dealing with political debate. But they are democratic, and like democracy itself, it's an absolutely terrible system, but it's better than any other system.
Yes. Well, I mentioned right at the beginning that you originally came from South Africa, and of course we associate South Africa with, in years gone by at any rate, with quite considerable demonstrations. Do you think there's anything we can learn from that experience, that how important demonstrations are to be tolerated?
I think we've got enough on our plate learning from our own experiences.
Yes. it is interesting that when the South Africans were coming to democracy and they looked around the world, they found the 1986 Public Order Act, the model to which they then rested their own public order law.
Right. So we have a fine system of public order, are you
well,
claiming?
Well, it takes a bit of beating. I mean, there aren't many places where you can protest by simply notifying you're going to protest. In the United States, you have to get a permit, land of the free.
Yes.
It's not a bad system, but of course it is a moving target. And that's the important thing, that the protest is always evolving and the police are always responding to it, and therefore the law and the infrastructure around it needs to be attentive to that and to protect the conventions and the spirit of the conventions that Lord Hoffman's referred to.
So you'd adopt Lord Hoffman's notion of a convention which is sort of additional to the law, in the formal structure of the law. There's a convention that people understand or should understand as to how things should be conducted.
As a matter of fact, that is far more influential than the law when we're on police behaviour.
Yeah. Stephen Craig, do you agree with that?
Well, I think one of the things which concerns me is Amy was talking about the broad powers that the police have, and I think one of the problems is that some of the powers are too broad and police officers... The exercise of the powers isn't defined enough. I think one of the important things is that the police powers are delineated, and also that police officers themselves understand some of these conventions, understand human rights to protest, and guidelines are there which mean that police officers know how they ought to be exercising their powers a lot more. And if things go wrong, we still have a system where any police complaints, almost all police complaints, are still investigated by the police themselves.
That takes us into a different era, I think. But anyway, subject to any protest or demonstration, I'm afraid I have to rule that's all the time we have for now. My thanks to all my guests, Lord Hoffman, Professor Jim Waddington, Stephen Craig and Amy Street. I'm Clive Anderson. Next week on Unreliable Evidence, can lawyers save the world, the environment and the law? Until then, goodbye.
Unreliable Evidence was presented by Clive Anderson and produced by Brian King. It was an above-the-title production for BBC Radio 4. Well, after the news, grey squirrels and poppies. Nature asks how we judge what should be cherished and what should be condemned. Now, it's 250 years since the birth of the writer, philosopher and feminist Mary Wollstonecraft. Now, to mark this anniversary, we've the second of our letters to Mary. This evening, Richard Reeves, director of the think tank Demos, writes to Mary about her vindication of the rights of man.
Dear Mary, I think that you of all people will forgive me if I begin by quoting your contemporary, the German poet Johann Goethe. He remarked that a person's true greatness was measured by what he labelled their posthumous productivity. I don't